So this time we'll try not to do some kind of waltz with our little machines.
Why not?
Speaking of one-man band, I think you... I feel like I just went to a concert that we should all be waving our lighters or cell phones or something. So I want to start with that kid in the cowboy outfit on the cover of Cuddy One Rock. So you wrote that you were the third of three children, and you came so late that your mother decided to let the dog raise you.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, and your sister lived in the attic.
Yes.
Learning Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And your brother was out, like, falling out of trees, and he was smart and great and athletic and fun and your hero. And when you were 7 or 8 years old, he called you obnoxious. And you wrote, "That was the moment I resolved to become a man of letters." So I want to know, were you aware at that point that there was some kind of magnetic pull happening for you toward books, toward words, toward the life of the mind? And in particular, what was it about that word obnoxious that really stuck in your craw?
I didn't know what it was, but which got my attention. I knew it wasn't something good, and I wanted to find out what it was. But I was also impressed that if a fancy word could do so much damage, I wanted that kind of thing in my quiver, going forth into the world. In answer to the earlier part of your question, My parents are readers, and my brother and sister were readers. During most of their growing up, television didn't exist. So by the time we got a TV in probably 1954 or so, I was the only one who watched it, and the family thought I was mildly retarded on account of it. it was a reading family, and that made a large difference. Reading was a good thing to do, and speaking properly. I think partly because my parents were both first generation Americans, and their parents had accents and limited English. It was important for them to speak well, and they were horrified both by my New Jersey accent and my vile mouth, but that's another story.
So do you remember them? I mean, obviously from the way you read your poetry aloud, and also I know that you are hearing, when you write poetry, you're thinking about how the words sound aloud, and I assume you're probably speaking it aloud as you're working on it. Do you remember your parents reading aloud to you? Did you have a sense of the life of words beyond the page?
Well, my parents read to me, as most parents, or many parents, at least those who have the time and inclination, read to their children. Nothing out of the ordinary. What was out of the ordinary is they read at night as opposed to watching television. As did my brother and sister. In terms of composing, I don't compose aloud, but I do hear it in my mind, both the rhythm and the texture of, and the duration of syllables and words. And so then I do roll it over. That was very much impressed into me in my early 20s when I was a student of Basil Bunting, who emphasized that way of composition.
Yeah. Would you talk a little about being his student and how you got there? You told a story in one of your books, I think it was in the introduction to Earthquake Weather, about having this almost, well, I guess prophetic experience. When you were a young man, you were visiting your brother, living with your brother in Manhattan, and had, you know, you carried translation, Peter Wiggum's translations of Catalyst in your pocket, and Ezra Pound's translation or anthology, Confucius to Cummings, in your pocket, and you walked into a bookstore and found...
I walked into the 8th Street bookstore in Greenwich Village. It used to be a great bookstore, no longer there like many bookstores, and they had a small press British fulcrum edition of Bunting's Brig Flats, which I had never seen. I'd just seen a couple of poems of his in the Confucius to Cummings anthology. And I was reading it in the store, and I just, bang, you know, the old thing, the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and that was really it. And I took it back to my, I was living with my brother in the village, and it was everything I wanted. It was just overwhelming. And then my brother's life began falling apart, and I decided to go back to school, and I'd been in the Pacific Northwest and stopped by Victoria while I was camping up there, and I'd been accepted. It wasn't a very good school, and it was also very cheap. So one day, you know, I hitchhiked out to Vancouver Island, began school again, and I wanted to take the a contemporary poetry course, and I asked one of the instructors there who's teaching it, and he said, "No one you have ever heard of. It's an old English fellow named Basil Bunting." And it was just one of those things. And so I got to study with him for a year. And he did a survey course of 20th century poetry in which he just read to us. And he was a smoker. He smoked unfiltered players. And when he got winded, he invited comments, which he always ignored. And in the creative writing section, and this I always took this to heart. I was very excited about this, and I'd worked for weeks, if not months. Well, that would have been weeks because I didn't know months in advance. I wrote a very Bunting-esque, what I thought was a Bunting-esque poem, very complex, very dense and crabbed, and I brought it in. You know, we mimeographed in those days. This was, this was an undergraduate course, and there's a thing, we pass it around. You give it to the teacher, and you pass it around, and Basil read it, and then he put his face in his hands, and he didn't move for about 5 minutes, and I said, "Oh Jesus, I killed him." And he said, he had that Northumberland accent. He said, "Mr. Kleinsauer, I don't know if I've suddenly become ill, or I'm just terribly tired, or if it's this awful, awful poem." So shortly thereafter, the class size shrunk. So there were only about three of us, and we used to visit with him. He had a little house, a little bungalow down by the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and he just read to us and played us Baroque music and told us stories and gave us beer, and and that's the way writing should be taught to young people. You have someone, yeah.
Yeah, you've definitely got some strong opinions about the way writing is taught and whether it can be taught. I know.
Well, it can't be taught. That's, you know, it's fairly straightforward. You can't teach someone to be a poet. What a preposterous! It's like teaching someone to be kind or sexy. You know, it's only America would come up with something like that. You
know? Well, although you have, you know, I know that you taught the homeless vets at Intersection, and you have, on a few rare occasions, been convinced to go teach at some of the most prestigious writing programs in this country. So when that happens, I mean, I'm sure teaching the veterans was a very different experience, you know, than it is to teach graduate writing students. But so what do you do when you get there? I mean, what is it that you feel like you can give them or guide them in?
It's always the same. I read to them and have them read, and I have them do some exercises, and I discourage them from bringing in poems of their own. This usually results in a mutiny by week 3 or 4, and they usually send a committee of students to my office hours, and I say, "What are you doing? Don't you know why we're here?" And then I surrender pathetically and sit back and let them filate each other for the remainder of the semester.
Well, I have a quote from one of the other interviews that you've done about what can be taught. And what is it that you said?
Well, you can teach habits of
that's exactly what you're saying, that you can teach them techniques to edit themselves, but that language as a poetic expression is hardwired, that and that there has to be a strange psychological setup in there somewhere in you to trigger it. So what do you think, for you, what was the trigger?
Well, anyone who has been raised by a dog is going to be a little bit unusual. that's for starters. And those of you who have been regularly attending this wonderful Lannan series, will you know, figure it out by now that, you know, there are a lot of peculiar people in this line of work. You know, sometimes we shower and put on, you know, pressed clothing, but it's a pretty thin membrane.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier, and many people who have written about your work have written about that the counterpoint quality that your poetry has, that you're balancing, you know, as some people say, the high and the low, but it's far more complex than that. It's subject matter and it's form and it's music and sound. And one thing I was thinking about is that you came from this family where on one hand, you describe some of your relatives as basically bog people from outside of Kiev. And then you've got your mom who loved her Shakespeare Club and your dad who, you know, didn't get any formal education after high school, but he collected antiquities, as he called them, and paintings, and was a painter himself. And so, on one hand, you live in Fort Lee, where you've got gangsters and Buddy Hackett as your neighbors, and then you said you were, you know, probably the only boy in the 1950s who spent more time in the Museum of Modern Art than the curators. And so, I wonder if there's that balance that's the hard wire for you, that you had these two kind of competing elements.
I don't think they were competing. It just didn't occur to me what a peculiar family I came from. My father was really someone of a wonderful sensibility. He was also rather erratic psychologically, but fucking violent. It's wonderful to have a father who loves the arts. He loves reading, loves pictures and sculpture, and is curious about them. He was the typical, or the prototypical autodidact, and he went into the city almost every weekend to go to the Modern Museum, the Frick, the Whitney. And because I was the baby, he dragged me along, and it was pleasant because he was happy when he was doing that. And he also dragged me to auctions and antique stores and flea markets, and And I thought that was, you know, how, you know, only later did I learn that, you know, kids get under the car with dad, you know, and mess around with the carburetor, go to the Yankees game. And I thought everybody, you know, went to flea markets with their dad. But in other ways, you know, we're very conventional. Where I go in a poem, boo, 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 is that high, low, blah, blah, is, I mean, that's where I go. That's how I grew up. And I always say as an adult, it's not unusual for me to go from a museum into a gin mill and watch a football game. It's not a self-conscious thing. So I move amidst high culture and kitsch, and I don't do it self-consciously. It's just how I go. I enjoy both, and it turns up in the poetry. And it's terribly upsetting to critics, it seems. But
well, it's one of my favorite mental images of you is that you and Tom Gunn were very good friends after you moved to San Francisco. And if you're not familiar with his work, Tom Gunn was a British poet who was sort of the great poetic hope of his generation in the 50s. And formally, incredibly gifted, and ended up moving to the United States, and really, I think, becoming the greatest American poet of the gay experience in this country, and wrote incredibly movingly about the 80s and how AIDS changed the face of life for so many young men especially. But also he was just, as you said, an incredible critic of poetry. And I'm curious about your relationship with him, and did what you did your own work, do you feel like your own work was influenced by your relationship with him? I know that he read your work.
Yeah, it's a good question. We were very different poets, and we weren't going to become, I wasn't going to become more like him. Nor would he have encouraged that. He wasn't, I mean, among his wonderful traits, he really didn't need or want acolytes. I think he, you know, he made me a better teacher and a better critic of my own work, and he taught me to be careful about, you know, resorting to old tricks, and just, you know, kept me awake. It's wonderful to rub up against someone who's brighter and more talented than you are, and who, you know, he was very helpful. He wanted me to succeed, which is a very rare thing in the world of poetry, I should mention. I mean, part of it was because he was so much older and very famous, and it was wonderful having a reader like that and a critic like that. And the friendship was close enough that he could be very direct, if not cruel, which he sometimes enjoyed doing. It couldn't have been a more useful. It was a wonderful gift having him as a friend and neighbor, and it was just kind of accidental. It was a beautiful friendship that lasted, 25 years. It didn't want for anything. You know, I was sad when he died, but it was just one of those. It was fulfilled, you know. I wish you were around too, because I could show you this or that. It was just great. But I do miss him.
Yeah, I loved picturing the two of you out. You wrote a story or told someone the story of going to see Pulp Fiction together, because you guys like to go have martinis and go to movies, your martini matinees. And in the middle of watching Pulp Fiction, that all of a sudden Tom said, Augie, that's what you do. That's exactly what you do. And I think it was must have been the scene with John Travolta and Uma Thurman talking at a cafe or something.
It was in the cafe. I think it was with Travolta and Samuel Jackson.
Yes, okay.
And I think what he meant, they would come up with a particular locution or expression, and Tarantino would kind of isolate it and frame it. I think that's what he had in mind. We never discussed it further than that, and I wanted to see the movie. But he seemed to have a revelation during that, and he was great fun to go to movies with. That's what our friendship evolved into, our martini lunch and a matinee, and that was great.
You know, it's so funny thinking. I had a little revelation of my own when I was reading your recent essay for the London Review of Books about selling off and packing up your childhood home, which I think you called it your psychological redoubt. You know, the place that made you feel solid and centered in the world, even though you've actually been moving around. You know, you haven't lived there for over 40 years, and that you've been going back and forth between the East Coast and the West Coast, and there's clearly a tension that has entered your work from that. I even read it in the poems you write from the West Coast have a different tone and a different music to them. They move differently. There's a different, even the level of detail seems very different than the ones from the East Coast, which have more of almost more of a bebop feel, and there's like a percussive quality that just sort of feels like not pacified, but you know, the West Coast poems feel more Pacific. And now that you've left that house, you know, sold it off to the sweet young couple who are starting their life there, how does that feel for you? Do you think it's going to change your work?
I don't know. It's a horrible feeling because that was my foothold on the East Coast, and I don't know. Frankly, we'll see. I do. Need to get back there. I mean, it's like getting a transfusion for me.
Not just the hot dogs.
Hot dogs are good. as much as anything else, it's the river light. I grew up on the Hudson, on the Palisades, and the air and the quality of light, the aroma of the river, Manhattan across the way, and of course going, you know, being able to go into Manhattan easily and out. I don't know. We'll see. I've got to figure something out here.
Well, you've stayed in San Francisco for a long time, so there must be something, too, that has held you there.
Yeah, rent control apartment.
Yeah. How did you end up there?
I just lucked out. I visited the apartment I now live in with a girlfriend. And one of her workmates had just been robbed. So we sat with her and got her drunked up and got her some Chinese food. And she thought I was a nice fella, and she was frightened. She said, well, why don't you move in with me? And, you know, for $100 a month. And I'd always wanted to live in San Francisco. First time I passed through when I was 19, I said, I can do this. And, you know, it agreed with me. It still does. And I'm still in that apartment 30 years later. And she's pissed off that she's not.
and collecting your, you know, amassing your extraordinary collection of music.
Well, it's ebbed and flowed. At a tight after I won that Lila Wallace Award when we worked together. It was a three-year award. And I never had so much money and so much time. And there was this wonderful record store that it was a perfect storm, Amoeba Records on Haight Street. And you know, by the end of 3 years, I had 2,500 CDs. And then I didn't have any money. So I had to sell the CDs to survive. And I wrote an article about it called Triage. And then a woman editor in Berkeley who worked for the San Diego Reader read it and said, would you like to become our music critic? I said, I never wrote about music. She said, fake it. So I did that for 3.5 years, and it was the most wonderful gig I ever had. I've slowly begun reaccumulating CDs, but not so many as I had. And then I rewrote those essays recently, and that's the book, Music, which was fun. I enjoyed rewriting them. They needed rewriting.
Do you actually listen to music while you're writing poetry? Because
never.
No, really? Because I would think there's so much music going on. I mean, not just your references to music and musical artists and composers, but the movement of your lines is so clearly informed by music. I just figured that you're actually embodying it while you're writing.
No, I have to hear the music of the language in my head. I can do that in a noisy room, or a room with people talking, curiously enough, but I can't do it with music going, because I guess I listen to the music. I can shut out voices or filter voices. But, some people can. I remember Robert Creeley talking about listening to Charlie Parker when he wrote. Mm-hmm. But when I listen to Charlie Parker, I listen to Charlie Parker. And when I write, I write. Everybody's different that way. But certainly music, I do listen to music, and it informs the way I write. I'm not quite sure how, but it's in there. It's in the mix, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. And what about in terms of the poets that, I mean, we've talked about Bunting and I know that William Carlos Williams was really important to you when you were younger. Are there contemporary poets who you pay attention to now? Who?
None of the likely subjects. There are some...
You have said it's a rather gutless time for poetry, so...
Well, yeah, but there are interesting writers out there. And I think, as always, has been the case for nearly a century, the most interesting stuff is in the small press world, which is kind of drying up. But there's a wonderful poet in New York who's not a spring chicken named Michael O'Brien. Published by Flood Editions, which was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle
Sleeping
Award.
Sleeping and Waking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an earlier book published in Boston called Sills. There's a wonderful poet in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a house painter named Robert Vandermolen. There's, I think, a terrific poet in her 40s, and she's in New York these days, Maureen McLean, who's got a book and another book coming out with Farrar Straus, and Tom Pickard, the British poet, who's in his, I guess he's getting 64-ish or so, who's at Joshua Tree National Park at the moment. That's a long story. A book he wrote called The Saddest Month of May or something like that for Flood Editions, which is a terrific little press in St. Louis, I think was the most interesting book published in Britain, certainly in the last decade, and it was completely ignored in Britain. You know, there is a mafia this one, in New York and London, and, you know, I'm well pleased to be part of it, or the back end of it. I don't get invited to the parties, but, you know, we publish people like August Kleinzahler too, you see. But I don't think people look hard enough at what's going on in the small press world. And there is stuff getting done. But usually people are, you know, usually people are exposed to the usual suspects who are collectively not very interesting, in my opinion.
Well, I think we may have to...
On that negative note, people,
no,
will,
that's
people,
terrible.
People will think I'm a naysayer.
Yeah, well, that is... Well, actually, there is something else I wanted to ask you.
Yes?
Yes. that you have said that you agree with Auden, that poetry has no use, basically. And, you know, I have to disagree with you about that, because I saw... well, I know from my own experience of it and how much it means to me. And I know, say, just watching 20 years ago when you were doing those workshops with those homeless vets, and I remember you'd come in periodically to do whatever paperwork, and we'd ask you how it was going, and you'd say, well, they're a pretty screwed-up bunch, not really ready for, you know, public consumption, but I... think maybe they're liking it. And then one time you brought them in. Part of this project was putting a book together of their work. And you brought them in to get their photographs taken. And they were very shy. They didn't necessarily want to have a whole lot of conversation. But one by one they went and, remember, they got their pictures taken.
Oh, that's
and,
right, yeah.
And they were transformed. It was really amazing. And you know, I have to say, I think then poetry has a use. That
well, that was social work. That wasn't poetry. That was just getting to talk about their lives and giving them permission to talk about dark things, painful things in their lives. You know, there were somebody. There was something there. They weren't just riffraff and. So, I mean, it was successful, what we set out to do, but the relationship to poetry, per se, I think, is rather peripheral.
Right. But do you see art as a social contract? I mean, that there is some kind of, you know, you're not writing into a void, necessarily. So as a poet, do you have an awareness of your audience? Or is it really purely that you have to do what the poet, what the poem needs you to do?
I think if you look at a painting of Vermeer, and you say, "Christ, that's beautiful." That's it. That's about as far as the contract goes. And I think that's enough. There's enough ugliness and waste to make something beautiful and share it. I don't know beyond that what its role is. You know, what does listening to a Beethoven violin and piano sonata do for you? You know, if you like it, it enchants you. It doesn't make you a better person. It's just what it is. And I think that's what's wonderful about it. It doesn't do anything except delight you. And that's what I think is the function of art.
Well, that... That I have to completely agree with. You know, it is... The function is delight. And on that note, I wonder... Immediately I had to think again of my favorite of your poems. And I wonder if you might just give us one last poem in closing. Would you do
sure.
it? Okay. I know you know the one I'm talking about. Let's see if I can find it.
It's a New Jersey poem.
It is a New Jersey poem. Let's see. Do you remember where it is? Let's see. It is...
Is it in green?
Oh, you know what? That's the easier way to find it. Exactly. Here. You can see it's my favorite because it's the one... All of my notes in this book are in the back, and I've just got my one tag here.
Thank you. Watching dogwood blossoms fall in a parking lot off Route 46. Dogwood blossoms drift down at evening as semis pound past Phoenix Seafood and the Saverin plant, west to the turnpike Patterson, or Hills Beyond. The adulterated pearly light and bleak perfume of benzene and exhaust make this solitary tree in the last of its bloom as stirring somehow after another day at the hospital with mother and the ashen old ladies lost to TV reruns flickering overhead, as that shower of peach blossoms Du Fu watched fall on the riverbank from the shadows of the Jade Pavilion, while ghosts and the music of yellow orioles found out the seam of him and slowly cut along it.
That is the heart of my delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you all for being here and indulging me in doing what I wanted to do most tonight. And if you would like to join us outside in the lobby, there are books for sale, and I know that Augie will be happy to sign for you. And thank you all for coming.